Hello and welcome to the Gestalten Podcast. My name is Martin Groschwald, and in this episode, we are talking to one of the legends in Californian car design in our series, Car Design in California. And I had the pleasure in Newport Beach, actually, a little bit ago, to sit down with the one and only Chris Chapman. Now, what makes Chris very special, he has been a very integral part over the past 30 plus years in the Californian car design community. And he has been involved in particularly with the German studios, with the Korean studios as well. So he has seen the build up firsthand of various satellite studios that have made a massive impact on the headquarters in Europe or in their respective Korean home bases. Now, Chris will share a little bit of the how it used to be, how it is now, what he sees was great in the day, but what should maybe not continue in today's culture, but also what is kind of been missing a little bit in nowadays world. So we're very excited to have him with us on the podcast, one of the very few and rare occurrences on the public media with Chris, and it was an absolutely lovely conversation with him. So without further ado, please enjoy the conversation with Chris Chapman. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Martin.
It's good to have you here.
Nice to see you.
It's nice to see you too. We just came from a very, very nice lunch, and I hope we're not going to fall asleep from all the
February in California, right?
February just, in California,
just like the winter time in Munich.
Pretty much. Yeah, it's more like summertime. Yeah. And I think we can also say that we're looking out of the window. We see the beach. We see the ocean.
We just had some major rain here too, so that's unusual.
I know. But now the sun is shining. So it is actually what California
Such
is all
boring
about.
Boring weather.
I know. It's like, why are we doing this? You know,
drove all the way down here for this.
I know. Okay. I know. Next time we do it in LA.
Yeah, you know, let's go get a beer.
We will do that eventually, but let's have a little bit of a chat first.
And make sure.
I want to start with a little something. I want to, and I hope you don't take this in the wrong way. I want to call you the grand seigneur of Californian car design, because I think you're one of the very, very few people who've been here through quite a long time, but have seen everything in that context. You've worked with the Germans. You've seen the push with the Koreans, of course, and everything as well. You've worked with some of the biggest names in car design, like with Chris Bangle and pushed things with Project Blue and all these kind of things. Tell me a little bit about your view on Californian car design, having done this for a few years. What is really Californian car design, and what does it make it so special and different?
Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much for framing me up that way. I don't know if I should thank you or slap you. I don't know. I think first things first, I stand on the shoulders of giants, you know. I think a common thread that goes through me and several of the people that I admire is kind of a sense of where you come from, a good background, a certain level of humility. I think it's important to have that in order to sort of absorb what's kind of around you. Now, I think speaking about California, I grew up here. Mm-hmm. I'm a native of Pasadena, actually. I'm one of the few people that I ever knew that went through a school like Art Center that is from Pasadena. But I can tell you that it's because not of the typical sort of car culture that exists here since forever. Yeah. Things that you would associate with films like American Graffiti. But for me, the stories of aerospace, the stories of Hollywood, the stories of technology, of these areas in and around where I grew up, helped form or frame up or forge a long-lasting relationship with cars and car culture, right? So it's really the periphery around the actual automobile, really, that is unique to this area. I'm a big fan of places like Lockheed, for instance. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of aircraft and sort of space and things like that. So I could almost talk to you about aircraft as much as I could talk to you about cars. So for me, the special qualities come from the other industries, the entertainment industry. There have been a lot of breakthroughs within, say, Hollywood, animation, certain softwares or whatever that are developed that help Hollywood do its job that have inspired the processes within car design.
Yeah.
Right. And so those types of things give me the sense of, you know, California is a special place. And I've tried to be part of teams and cultures and run studios with the sense that proximity matters and that where you are feeds into why you're doing what you're doing. Mm. And should be in a unique perspective. It should be a special, should have a special quality to it. It's not all about the sunshine that we're seeing right now all the time, but the fact that this place has provided so much inspiration due to the fact that, you know, these certain other industries or whatever are here and inventing things, creating things, being inspired by things. Everyone talks about the weather. Everyone talks about, you know, the beaches or whatever it is. But to me, it's about why these other industries or whatever have established themselves over the decades, over the generations that have fed into what I think is, you know, considerably a much slower moving industry, the automobile world, right?
Is that also, you know, like, do you think that's also because, or like the reason why we have so many satellite studios here, like, you know, to have concepts, to have these kind of ideas, because we have to be realistic. There's very few traditional production studios here. Now a little bit more with Rivian, with Lucid up in Northern California as well, Tesla, who really then produce here as well, or like at least in the country, very, very close by.
Yeah.
But do you think historically that's also one of the reasons why these satellite studios were here, because of exactly what you have just mentioned?
Yeah, I agree with that to a large extent. I think at the beginning, to places like, you know, one of the oldest, Calty, or whatever, the experimental nature of that setup, that studio, whatever, due to the personalities that created that, that sold the idea of having the studio out here, right? All the way to the present day. I think it's, in a way, it's kind of eroded. We talked a little bit about this sort of not invented here syndrome. Mm-hmm. I think that has changed it fundamentally. But at least the early motivations and the early intentions of creating a satellite studio was to see and to monitor a place like this and to see, okay, what can you guys come up with that cannot be invented where they are? So the whole charter, the whole mantra or whatever for a satellite studio, in my opinion, is to do things that cannot be replicated in the mothership. That's really what you're all about. And so you do that as a satellite studio, you function that way. And then comes the problem of, well, you guys over there in California, you're playing or whatever, we're doing the real work over here at the mothership. So I've had the opportunity to work, you know, BMW headquarters, which is fantastic. And I understood that mechanism, that I call it that fettuccine machine that just cranks. Doesn't matter if people come and go or whatever, it just keeps moving or whatever. And it's a wonderful environment.
I mean, truly a
wonderful environment to experience or whatever, especially after years of working in a satellite studio where you're more or less at the tip of the tail of the dog that you occasionally can steer.
Yeah.
Right. But it's, for the most part, you're on this wild ride at the tip of the tails, you know, and it just, you're just hanging on for dear life. But every once in a while, as a satellite studio, you're able to recognize something, you see something, you monitor, sense, and then you can bite down on that tail and then the whole dog wakes up and goes. That happens very, very rarely. And one of the disappointing, I think, things that designers experience when they are part of a satellite studio is that they have this expectation that they're going to come in and they're going to change the world and they're such a great sketcher and hot designer, and they can do all the tools and techniques or whatever. And then, you know, a few years goes by and all they want is to get a car on the road, yeah. right? Or they want to get a show car out there for notoriety or whatever, you know. And they don't realize the infrequency with which that happens. We had an architect come in and give the designers a speech. We had a program that I ran at Hyundai, and we had them come in, different people from different industries, just talk about their yeah. work. And I remember this one architect that came in, and he had worked, I think, 25 years before he actually had a design of his, you know, implemented yeah. and built whatever. Yeah. Up until that point, he was doing staircases yeah. and, you know, utility rooms and, you know, industrial. It wasn't residential architect, whatever. And I remember the looks on the designers' faces. They were kind of like, their jaws were like, are you kidding me? You've worked that long and you don't have anything to sort of like show for it that you can yeah. say you did that building or whatever kind of thing. And I said, yeah, that's if you're going to be part of a satellite studio, you have to accept the premise that your existence here is your impact or whatever here is going to be kind of like, if you're lucky, you get that shot
yeah.
and then it kind of goes through or whatever, gets picked up kind of thing. More often than not though, the time passes and you work like a dog, you push hard, you love something, you're falling in and out of love with projects, right? You're, as a designer, you're asked to love this thing for a couple months, mm-hmm. 3 months or whatever, and then it gets killed. And then you get depressed and you drag yourself through the mud or whatever. And then your boss says, okay, start over again, heal the wounds. And the idea is to, you're in it for the long run, that you don't develop so much scar tissue that you forget how to love.
Yeah.
You forget how to feel. You forget how to, you know, involve your emotion and buy into what you're doing next and believe in it kind of thing. Right. And so, but for me, I don't know if it was my personality or whatever. My dreams came true, Mark. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, I was going to be an engineering student at UCLA, and then I found out about this thing called car design, and what is this? And oh my God, there's this school in my hometown. Are you kidding me? And all that kind of stuff. And then I started to imagine myself, well, can I be a car designer? Is that even possible? Is it it's such a razor's edge to walk, to hit that corridor where you can get in the club? You know, and then you make it, and then you have dreams and aspirations of becoming a leader within a small team. That's all I ever wanted, actually, was to not actually be the leader at the headquarters, but, you know, the small team where I could interact very intimately
yeah.
with. And I've had the chance and the opportunity to do that a couple of times. And so those dreams had come true. Right. So, but they were dream. I really didn't have expectations, and I'm very rare in this regard, of really getting a car into production. I mean, with the X5, when it was announced that they were going to kill it for a year, Bangle called me up,
yeah.
and he said, and I was sitting there in the studio, and he called me up and he goes, "Yeah, we're gonna shelve the car." And I said, "Oh, okay." Why, you know, kind of why, whatever. And there was some yeah. cannibalization kind of considerations at the time with Rover, with the Range mm-hmm. Rover and stuff. And they were like, okay, we're going to do this car, whatever. And then like a year later, so he goes, yeah, we're going to kill it. We're on like that. And I said, okay, what's next? I literally had poured my heart and soul into this project. And I mean, I spent a long time in Italy, away from my wife, away from, at the time, my fiance, before I got married or whatever, away from my family, et cetera, in Munich, working on this project or whatever. And for it to get a phone call from him and say, hey, Ace, we're killing it. It's going in the M. Keller. And I said, okay, all right, what's next? And he goes, you're a pro, man. and I literally was like, I had to divorce myself from this thing and go, okay, what's next? And that's the attitude you have to have at a satellite studio.
Yeah.
What's next? Keep going. Hope is a big thing within a satellite studio. But getting back to kind of California and how it relates to that kind of thing, again, with architects, with aircraft design and how long a period of time goes in between models. At BMW, it's 7 years or or whatever, right? You gotta, you're running a marathon here, guy. It's not about like next year, oh yeah, you're gonna be wearing the big watch and the black sweater and the turtleneck at the car show and hey, I did this and hey, give me a raise and or I'm gonna go to the next company kind of thing, right? So, yeah, California, you have to have the right approach. You have to have the right mentality in the satellite studio to kind of, I think, survive, but also thrive and not be preoccupied with the production car. What you need to be preoccupied with is the company, where the company wants to go. Hook your train car up to that and go, okay, I'm going to help. Mm-hmm. I'm going to contribute. You know, the word is contribution.
Yeah.
At a satellite
station. How do you, if you could choose, how would you love that the company sees our satellite studios? Yeah, because when we've seen it, especially in California recently, there's been a couple of studios that's been, you know, that have been closed. You have smaller studios, you have bigger studios. But the question always remains is like, what role do they play within the bigger scheme in that sense? Do you think that's a question that the leaders have to answer so that they say that's the role that we want to play? Or well, there's the fire engine coming. That's proper California.
It's the guy with the straitjacket coming to take me away.
No, but do you think it's the role of the leader to then say that's the role we want to play for the company, or does the company have to give you that direction?
A good question. I think it's for me. It's mostly the latter. They have to want the satellite studio to begin with. What's it for? Agree upon why you're establishing the place, where, what, why the location matters, the proximity matters, or whatever, to whatever it is that you're looking to tap into. Right? Agree on that. Understand that that's the premise of the place. Right? The charter of the satellite studio. All right. Unfortunately, I think people, companies, executives, whatever, managers, chiefs, they can't get out of their own way to see past that sort of objective for their own sake when they look upon what they're doing in the headquarters as the most important work that that's to be done. Right. And It's unfortunately an immature way of looking at something like that. You know, you know, we've often referred to Chris as being, you know, highly influential, and he was. He often referred to the design studio as the church. Maybe you've heard this from him or other through other people or whatever, but he saw it as a place where you had to believe or you weren't let in, you know, and he was guarding that and he was the lightning rod to it all, right? He got all the criticism and all the deserved credit as well along with it, but he saw it as a very special place. And I think he saw places like satellite studios as the potential to create the wild card, which is a concept that I really, really learned and developed and believe in, that you can follow a process. The headquarters are fantastic at following process and making reports and hitting the actual target that they created at the beginning of a project in the bullseye every single time, 100% of the time kind of thing. But what Chris did and what I understood to be of value from the satellite studios and quite frankly, other sources that he would tap into in Italy or from whoever, whatever, is this idea of, you know, let's open up the window in the side of this place to maybe something will creep in. And we don't know, you know. I think, you know, just like within faith, there's the mystery to it. There's in within design, there's a mystery to what can potentially crawl through and change everything for everybody's benefit kind of thing. And so when you follow a process, which is what the headquarters are really good at, you're going to get more or less an expected, the expected answer, right? That target doesn't really change very much, right? From the satellite studio, if you give them the freedom and you have earned trust from your leaders or whatever, which I believe that we did, you're able to sort of go, yeah, what about, we don't really know necessarily what we're doing,
yeah.
But there's this thing, this guy's kind of cooking up something over there, you know? And it's like, whoa, where did that come from? I don't know. It's mysterious, right? It's a beauty. There's a beauty behind that mysterious quality. And I think that it's not just California. It's any place where you're able to separate and extract out of that machine, that fettuccine machine, and into a cell, if you will.
The design factory.
let them create what this main thing can't do on its own, right? That's the beauty of it. And like I said, you know, you're not always going to hit it. And you're also up against preconceptions and unfortunate prejudices that'll happen with regard to jealousy or whatever, you know? And it's unfortunate because I've said, you know, I've seen and heard about a lot of great designs that I've witnessed or whatever that you just go, oh, if only, if only they could have just like it ships over there. You know, I always have this view of if I were in Michigan, if I were in Seoul, if I were in Munich, you know, when the package comes from California, you know, and the crate, they open it up. And I've seen this happen a couple of times where it's kind of opens up and people are kind of standing around with their hands in their pockets looking at it and they're curious or whatever. The cover isn't off of it yet, but they've moved it out of the crate. And then all of a sudden they pull the cover off of it and they're just kind of like, yeah, you know, whatever. And justifiably so, in a lot of cases, it's kind of like, eh, just extra medium. You know, it's like, meh, milk toast, lukewarm, whatever.
Yeah.
But there are times where it's like, you know, that's good and you can't admit it. You can't just get past yourself and just go, isn't that the fucking coolest thing that you've ever seen, right? And I'm unfortunately, I think it's a dilemma that most of the companies have.
Yeah.
You know, that they
let me ask you this. Has anything changed when you were at any of the studios after Tesla became big? Because there was obviously then the big EV hype that started through that.
Yeah.
As well as, of course, also, hey, they do it here. So, you know, they are up in Torrance. They are really on the local market here. They know the infrastructure and all these kind of things. Has anything changed on how your studios, when you were working at them, have been seen?
Think back. Yeah. I think locally within our four walls, we might have been maybe a little bit like jealous of the freedoms or whatever that seemed to have been given to them, say. I know at BMW, we never really benchmarked too much there. You know, there was a time where you could utter the words Mercedes-Benz or something like that, and that would sort of stop a conversation inside any conference room or whatever. But for the most part, I would say BMW really knew its own identity pretty confidently. And they had been experimenting with, you know, you'd see, you know, these test cars and things and electric or whatever. So you knew that it was coming and how it was going to manifest. You'd seen EV1 from, you know, General Motors or whatever, and some of these other ones that they kind of come and go or whatever. I remember having seen, I think I saw Model S, I want to say I saw it for the first time at Art Center, actually, at the show there. I can't really remember. I think there was kind of, you know, on the outside, people were like perhaps dismissing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the inside, walking away going, oh boy, mm-hmm. like what's this going to be kind of thing. And I can tell you ever since then, you know, I got this funny experience with one of my design managers at Hyundai. I was sitting in his office and we were working out like location of cup holder. It was a really, you know, oh God, you know,
a very American just discussion.
A headache inducing kind of conversation. We put it over here. We're going to move it 3 millimeters to the left and that'll, you know, clear the shift throw and the, all this stuff or whatever. But in the meantime, he on his computer had, because he was all interested in space as well as, yeah. as I am. And he would, and we were watching the rockets land back onto the, mm-hmm. the two rockets landing yeah. back simultaneously yeah. onto their landing things or whatever in perfect unison, yeah. perfect timing, flawless kind of thing. And this is this dude that also makes cars. Right. And me and my design manager are discussing at great length where to put the cup holder kind of thing. And so you can imagine the advanced, even when the cars were introduced, the advanced sort of like, hey, they're out in front, you yeah. know, by what feels to be a long shot right here. And they're also, I think, proving that you just do a normal looking car and it's not like, you know, we were kind of for years struggling with what does EV look like?
Yeah.
You know, and people are like, well, you know, paint it blue or put a blue decal on it or, yeah. or green swoosh or a pinstripe or something like that. And then it's electric or make it silver. Yeah. There's no grill or whatever. You know, it was like this kind of level of discussion rather than like going, hey, you know, it can just be a car,
yeah.
you know, and it doesn't have to be yeah. this, you know, this thing from outer space or whatever necessarily. So, yeah, I don't know if I'm, you know, capturing a huge fundamental shift. It was like a shockwave that hit. I think it was more of a roller kind yeah. of earthquake that kind of, you know, and is still sort of going with things like the Cybertruck.
So. Yeah. What's your feeling towards the tech industry over the time you've been here? Because for me, from the outside, you see California, you see companies like Google, Apple, yeah. Facebook/Meta, those kind of guys. And yeah. obviously when they became big in 2000s, you know, Amazon plays a role in that, I think, as well. But did they have an impact on what's been going on here as well, just because of how they were doing things, ecosystems, those kind of things? Did they have an impact, or was it more like, well, they're up there north and, you know, that's pretty much what it is and we're doing our stuff down here? Because it's not that far away.
No. I think there were grumblings again. It starts. You hear rumors. You had heard discussions. Oh, Apple's going to make a car. Oh, Google this, whatever. And you know, it spins kind of quickly out of control. And all the companies, they react to that quickly, and they're like, well, you know, automation and or autonomous. You know, that autonomous conversation goes in and out like crazy, you know. And I would start to speculate as to whether or not, you know, companies were asking the right questions. The quality of the answer that you were seeing or that you were given wasn't quite what I would feel answering the quality of the question that should have been asked by these companies, if I'm making any sense here. So, you know, I have it like with regard to autonomous vehicles, I have this sort of like, you know, there's now and sort of little semi-autonomous level 3, 4, maybe even 4 or whatever. And then it's like the world when it's all autonomous. Like I go over to this side and I'm wondering, okay, when is that? Because I don't think it's going to fundamentally really shift a lot of things. I see a lot of automated kind of technology make us really dumb drivers, make us really bad at what we're supposed to be paying attention to, kind yeah. of thing. So for me, it's like there's the world in which we know it now, and then there's like, okay, fully autonomous, but that changes so much, so many things. I mean, if you can imagine not only like cars driving themselves and you're just following navigation system, whatever, but if you looked at a car, if you follow a car home tonight or wherever you're going, and you could imagine all the things that you would remove from the car if it were completely mm-hmm. autonomous, like lights. Do you need lights?
Yeah.
Do you need lanes? Mm-hmm. Do you need signs? Like whole economy. Traffic tickets, you know, the whole insurance industry changes fundamentally. The whole economy, the whole ecosystem around mm-hmm. just that one thing. I think that places like Google or whatever, at least at the beginning, were probably thinking a little bit more on the local level of the car itself as opposed to the entire system. I know that they were testing things in Arizona, or they were driving around in mock cities and things like that. But I don't think they were looking at it from the standpoint of, like, say, for instance, in nature, when you look at birds and they call that phenomenon when they're flying all murmuring, right? It's when the bird is somehow, the birds are talking to each other. It's not just a one-way conversation. So a car isn't just sort of sitting there by itself with all of its LiDAR and all of its sensors or whatever, managing to navigate through stuff or whatever. It's also then talking to all of the cars around it for miles in front, for miles in back and all around or whatever, to sort of mimic that real autonomous ecosystem that I could imagine, and how that fundamentally changes the structure of the car, how people sit in the car, the whole safety aspects. I mean, it just, it's, it turns it upside down kind of thing. So what I was seeing for the longest time and still sort of continue to see are still manifestations of true autonomous world type of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, not really like, you know, changing roads with different stripes and paint and stuff like that.
But do you think, that California is a special place to bring something like this to life? Because we could argue, obviously, you know, the Zoox guys up in the north, but even topics as simply as Tesla Cybertruck, you know, where you could say, like, well, maybe that's environment over here that helps to develop something like that, both on a design side as well as on an engineering side. Because you know, we talked about this a little bit over lunch as well, but I don't really see a Cybertruck happening in Germany.
Yeah.
You know, we have protest
down against Leopoldstrasse, just
I mean, like, you know, this is a, like, I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand that in Germany there were protests because it was asked to have a full, like, you know, a speed limit, a speed limit in Germany for all the motorways. And we had protests against that because we wanted to go 200-250 kilometers an hour, you know? So it's a very completely different kind of mindset. Whereas if you look into like a Cybertruck, a Zoox, but even like a canoe, where you would think just like, could this even exist in any other place? Or is this also like, you know, a mindset and attitude question where you say like, well, we can do it here, but also because of the combination and everything goes on.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's, you know, that old adage of just because you can doesn't mean you should kind of thing or whatever.
That's very German, isn't
really,
it?
Yeah, but it is. I mean, everybody's used it. Everybody said it kind of thing. But I think sometimes the culture in California tends to suspend disbelief a little longer than most other cultures. Maybe they give, maybe we give ourselves a little bit more, what if, you know, maybe not answering fully the question why, or why are we doing it necessarily, but maybe getting a little long on our skis with what if, you know, and then seeing if we can post-rationalize it later and bring it into the fold, you know, of wherever that's happening. One person will see one problem with how we get around, or well, that could be done a little bit better or whatever. And they just press on that pedal till they can't press on it anymore to get, you know, one sort of answer. And then it either dies, or then either that person picks it up and brings it to the next level, or it gets picked up by another group and say, okay, you did that a little bit wrong. We're going to turn it this way and we're going to make it into, and it just sort of has legs. It keeps going. Yeah. It doesn't stop. It, and I think, you know, maybe there's a spirit of innovation here or whatever that just sort of says, you know, might state the problem really well. We might state the problem basically because we're living in you know, a lot of congestion, or we have developed spread out, you know, cities that aren't connected by trains or whatever, and so that it's provoked, and, you know, out of necessity we've had, you know, these other problems, these other sets of challenges that we need to address. And so due to that, the uniqueness of, you know, the whole, say, Southern California, or even, you know, I've often looked at like San Francisco. I love the city. I love it from the standpoint that it has just about every mobility challenge that you could you could collect and put together in one thing. And just sort of looking at it from afar, you start to see all the different sort of modes of mobility that San Francisco, a place like San Francisco, because of the terrain, because of the weather, because of the water, because of whatever it is and people. And it also is a little bit more condensed. It's a little more European, I would say, than say a place like LA. Right. So, but for Southern California and for this area, I think, you know, it's origins, its history, it's the way it was set up has also created a lot of unique things that you can't really necessarily experience elsewhere. So maybe getting back to your original question about, you know, tech and how that's might have changed things or whatever. I think from a process standpoint, definitely we've seen, you know, we were talking at lunch, the transfer over from the analog to the digital sort of kind of thing. And of course, I mean, these days, AI.
Yeah.
And then, you know, how that's all gonna, you know, kind of play out. So far, I'm not too impressed. I'm not so moved by it. Mm. But it's so, the quantity, right? The quantity of technology that's out there is almost, it's a little much for, you know, everyone sort of take in and say, okay, how is this going to impact, you know, everything from how I do something to how I get around to how even a company can either adopt and survive or not change and die kind of thing. You know, I mean,
how do you think talking about innovation in the studios, like, you know, like going from an analog to a digital workflow, those kind of things. Are the studios, at least the ones that you've worked with here, really experimenting with these new workflows to kind of say like, hey, we have to test those out because the headquarters maybe can't do it because of the process. So we can show them to do that. Or is there then again, almost like a catch 22 because they want us to be creative and they want us to be part of the factory, but maybe not as much so that you have a certain kind of freedom, but don't challenge the system too much because otherwise then we can't justify you guys being there anymore.
Really good question, Martin. Super, super intuitive, insightful question. I'm not satisfied with what I've seen. Mm-hmm. I'll speak a little bit about myself, but I could see something. I was the first person that did a digital sketch at BMW. And it wasn't through Alias Sketch and that whole suite of tools that were at the time and still are somewhat more expensive or whatever than, say, for instance, at the time, even before Photoshop, there was this thing called Fractal Painter that we got beta copy tests, samples or whatever from the local salesperson or whatever that he gave us a paint can. In the paint can was the disc. That was that. I've had an innovative spirit in me, and I've experienced certain tools that when they're the only game in town and they don't get challenged or pressured by something else, they tend to develop rather slowly. And that's why I say about like what Hollywood has. You'd see, hear about like what Pixar is using to make their animation. You go, what's that software? You know, what's Moto? What's the cinema? And you start to realize how slow your tools that you're working with. I often say, you know, it's sort of the, you know, for a long time in my town, there was just like Home Depot.
Yeah.
It's like Obi or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like Home Depot. It's like, that's the only game in town kind of thing. And you have to go there. Well, after a few years, you go up there and you're like, you know, Home Depot is a great place, but you would start to sense that their customer service would start to fail or the place would start to get messy or they didn't have really, it wasn't until the Lowe's, which is the other American, you know, that they come into town and they, now you have a choice. Now you have an option or whatever. Well, what happens, right, with them is they end up elevating each other's games and it's healthy and really good for both of them, right? So I remember when I was having this conversation with Bangle about like, okay, we want to play around with polygonal modeling, you know, get away from NURBS and see if we can move a little more fast, a little more efficient. Maybe we can move some of our processes a little bit more upstream so we can make some decisions earlier on rather than spend so much time on a digital model or whatever and then realize after, I don't know how many weeks or whatever, you'd go, oh, that's a piece of shit, you know? And now what are we going to do? Well, we're out of time, so hurry up and do something else kind of thing, right? Whereas the polygonal modeling kind of aspect started to open up this idea of looking at something really quickly and seeing if whether or not that's a it's a valid direction to go in the first place or whatever. And I remember approaching Chris with it and saying, okay, we need a few more bucks. It's not $100. We're talking about like $500 for something like Modo or Cinema 4D or something. It was some, I don't know, softwares or whatever we were messing around with at the time. And he said to me, okay, let's challenge Alias. Let's see if we can, you know, make it better, make them better, make something else better by challenging that whole thing. Right. So, ever since then, and right now I'm working, we worked a bit with Gravity Sketch, Flying Shapes, was another place, out of Germany. We've been, you know, looking at these digital softwares, these cutting edge kind of things, and using them in combination with the thing. I will say, to conclude this point, again, I'm not a huge believer in the silver bullet approach. For me, in everything that I do in life, it's always been about balance. Yeah. I think the answer comes with, in moderation. You don't drink, you know, 3 glasses of wine every day or whatever kind of thing.
Well.
You just say free. Yeah. But you sort of like, you know, balance your life out with everything. Right. And so, you know, we're talking about like doing hand sketches and the value of what that brings, doing a clay model. You know, one of my most favorite places to be in the design studio was in the clay studio, to sit with those guys, you know, not enough credit is given to, I'm going off tangent here a little bit, but like I do want to mention, you know, it's the people that you've worked with or whatever. So it's not just in isolation as a designer and you're using the most cutting edge tools and you're doing it by yourself kind of thing. And then it's all of a sudden you crack this, you spit this thing out and say, okay, now go build it, guys. And you walk away and you come back in a couple of weeks and they all kind of do it. The handwork, you know, the beauty of the collaboration, right? All of that. It's got to come into, I don't care if we're talking 50 years, 100 years from now, whatever. I do believe that you can't substitute the human aspect in the whole
and whole I think thing. This
like
is
you can hire a, excuse me, but you can hire a Sasha.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a one-man factory kind of thing. And there are plenty of them out there as well. I mean, I just mentioned him because we were talking about a little bit. But, you know, you can just go and hired gun, do it kind of thing. But I think you will, in the long run, take a loss by having it done in a kind of myopic manner.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, you have these studios to test things out. And I sometimes, testing things out means challenging the status quo to a degree and finding out that there's something different that you can do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do miss that kind of openness from time to time. Also in regards to, well, you know, that's what the headquarter pays us for to a degree as well.
Yeah.
We don't have to be great at everything. But we need to be open to test everything out. And I find that sometimes strange because you fall back into this, you know, the hamster wheel, if you want to say so. You're just like, well, we have to deliver this project and that project and all these kind of things. But what else do you deliver in the grander scheme that makes those studios really great and also like a constant development factor?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, if we want to be really honest, if we don't do something like that, you could now argue nowadays, well, do I need a satellite studio or could I also just work with any kind of people that live in that area and ask them to give me their opinion and, you know, I curate them myself. I think that's really like a core factor moving onwards as well and looking into the future, why these studios have a place here and why they should continue to stay here, apart from, of course, you know, market relevance and those kind of things. But if you don't have a feeling that you contribute something really like important to the entire group, the question will always arise. And I think that question is like, you know, the Damocles sword of everything.
Yeah.
Or you didn't say like, well, why are you still here?
Yeah.
And if it's just about the creativity or like, you know, in the projects, there will always be a question mark. If you bring something else to the party,
yeah,
the question will arise pretty much never.
Yeah. I remember during my early days, you know, out of school, and I was at Isuzu. It was my first job. And I remember I had about a year's worth of sketching real garbage. And basically, you know, I was really frustrated because I was working my butt off, and my bosses were basically telling me, that's not a truck. You know, we're doing SUVs or whatever kind of thing. You know, it's not a truck. And I was like, what do you mean it's not a truck? You know, what do you mean it's not an SUV? And it was like this long education and trial by error, trial by fire of drawing what a truck is inherently kind of thing. And I think that also applies to brand, that applies to the company. So yeah, you can contract a group of people, of professionals or whatever, that are going rogue, yeah, and they started their own thing, and that you can do as a consultancy and things. I do believe that there's great value though in when you establish a satellite studio and they are doing BMWs mm-hmm. for years. All right. Yeah. They may not be in the heart of, you know, the fatherland, you know? But they do develop their own understanding of the brand, yeah. I think. And I think that there is a value of that. I don't know if you can quantify it necessarily, but I do believe that, yeah, you'll get a good, maybe a pretty good result from this contract group or whatever, and they'll kick something in. You might even kick something in that whatever that's like, wow, we didn't think of it that way or whatever. And it has nothing to do with brand or identity or values and things. But I do think in the long run, you do take a loss there. So specifically to, you know, in-house value to satellite studios, I'm a big fan of that. From that aspect, again, for the most part, you're along for the ride, mm-hmm. but you are connected to that big dog. You know, you are a believer. You have traveled there. Yeah. You have, you know, experienced the culture there, yeah, and gone to dinners with colleagues and experienced things and played music with them. You've gone over to their houses and their spouses have cooked a home meal for you. You know,
yeah.
And I get a little emotional about this because, you know, Munich is very much in my heart and my soul, my family's heart and soul as well. And our experience with that made me feel like at the beginning I was walking around with a badge that was identification badge to get into the fits. And it was covered in a big yellow screen on top of my mm-hmm. photograph at the time, right? And basically it was like you were an outsider. You were from DesignWorks, which was a BMW owned company.
But you were
technically a contractor. And that changed one day too. I remember getting my badge, my FITS badge in the mail at DesignWorks in California and just looking at it. It didn't have that yellow thing on there.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah,
I'm a part of it. And when I go over there, and when I interact with the clay modelers who don't speak any English, but we can look at each other in the eyes, there is that value of people, mm-hmm. interaction, collaboration, family is a big word that I use when I consider that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Family within a design studio, within a satellite studio, is so important, and that can't be necessarily quickly replicated or whatever with a contract that a company might give to a XYZ group kind of thing. You know, having said that, there is great value in that sort of outsider's perhaps point of view as well too. But
yeah. How important do you see, especially something like, you know, like we're in California, the idea of an international, and I mean the workforce being international studio? Because,
huge.
You know, obviously huge. California in itself is, I would never say it's like fully American. You have the Mexican influence. You obviously have, you know, other cultural influences.
I loved Munich, the Fitz, because you'd walk in there and there was the French Quarter and the Italian guys over there, and there were a few Americans over here, and then Asian kind of thing here, whatever. And you're, you know, it was English guys over here kind of thing, but it was really diverse. You know, you felt like, you know, where am I again? You know, it was easy to comfortably exist, create, razz each other, that kind of thing. Quite often, the satellite studios can be that way. I've experienced, you know, at Design Works for sure, that at Hyundai as well. We've got a good mixture there. I will say that, you know, when I was at Isuzu, and you go to the headquarters in contrast to Munich, it was all Japanese.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You go to Hyundai, it's basically all Korean.
Yeah.
So that kind of diversity, whether it's just here in California or wherever you plunk it, whatever, it existed and still does exist in Munich, right? They're way far ahead. They are, you know, light years ahead in terms of that kind of, you know, acceptance and open-mindedness or whatever to doing that. Again, the location will influence whoever person, wherever they're from kind of thing. And it will, I don't think it just, you know, melts them into the sameness kind of thing. It definitely doesn't. There is, if anything, I think it highlights the differences or whatever, but you can really feel a camaraderie and a real sense of helping each other out or whatever. I mean, I look at, like, you know, I used to call him Byron Manny, but Manfred Meyer was one of the, you know, modelers there. I don't know if he's still there or whatever. I mean, there's so many names, so many people or whatever, but I just, again, he didn't speak any English, you know, but he would be so expressive in the stories that he would tell that I would just like look, I'd lock onto his eyes and he would like speak or whatever. And you can't, you know, express with words like the value of that one, two moments, you know, seconds, minutes or whatever of time that I spent with him or whatever, and what that does to the design, what that can do to the design. Yeah. When a person, when you see a person as invested as you are in your design, and they're going, yeah, we can do like this and we can make it like this. And kneel down on the thing. Look at it from here. Yeah. See your sketch? I think we can do. And they're showing such enthusiasm, right, towards something that you kind of started and created or whatever. And they're going to take it and
make it theirs almost.
Yeah, it is a dream come true.
Yeah,
it's incredible. I experienced this in Italy, working with some of the model makers at, you know, places like, you know, G Studio and Stola and these other names, Bertone and Pininfarina and stuff. And when you get guys that are in their 50s, maybe early 60s, I don't know, but they were well into their 50s, let's say, at the time when we were working on the X5. And this dude who's worked on Lancia Stratos, concept car and production car, this Miura, this Ferrari, this etc., Lamborghini, worked with Gandini and these guys. Yeah. And he was like, and they're working on your car. I'm a kid, you know, in there, and he's on his back underneath a rocker panel scraping plaster or scraping Epiwood. You know, you can't help but feel honored to just sweep the floor there. Yeah. That's your job. That's the way I walked in there. I'm like, what? You did those cars, whatever, and you're asking me questions about what we should do with the design and stuff. And like, all I want to do is make your workspace clean and make it as nice as possible, because you're on your back.
Yeah, you're on your knees. Helping me to bring that to life.
Exactly. You know, and it kind of makes me like, I'm like, with the technology, back on the topic of technology, but like, You know, let the mill
yeah.
take care of that rocker panel. Why are these guys on their knees? You know, why? I mean, we had car lifts and they'd bring it up to this level where they could scrape the rocker panel at eye level, whatever. But that seems ridiculous. Can't we get better at that in the tube and on the mill and let all that stuff do it and let those guys focus on what's really important?
Yeah.
So that they don't, you know, wreck their knees kind of thing.
Let us look a little bit into the future, because obviously you're also an instructor at Art Center. So mm-hmm. you have worked with a lot of people in the past as well. What are the biggest challenges and also opportunities within car design in California in the next few years for you?
I think COVID taught us and continues to teach us, hopefully, if we're open to it, mm-hmm. a lot of lessons. I recall, again, on this idea of hybridizing your work and what you do, you know, whether you're working with people or whether you're working sort of by yourself and how you're inspired and how you do creativity. I think this forced thing that COVID made for a lot of the workplace and a lot of the design or creative spaces that you are, sort of left to your own or entrusted with this, or we were forced to work that way. I think it would be for the betterment of companies industry wide to not abandon mm-hmm. those lessons and what that could perhaps unleash in terms of potential and creativity and energy mm-hmm. and collaboration and flow and interaction. I find it really sad to hear about companies that went through that and it was an ordeal. And then we're now in 2024, like it never happened kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there was nothing that they pulled from that. Not only just learning, but like anything. It's like saying there was nothing good about mm-hmm. that. You know, we're just going to go back to our old. That's not creative. That's not, you know, innovative
yeah.
brains at work, I believe so much. I think that, you know, they just thought of it as an operational nightmare and security nightmare and cost, whatever kind of thing. And, oh, well, we paid for that building and that real estate, so we've got to justify it by populating it with people in there and turning the power on and whatever kind of thing, as opposed to really like, what are we doing? You know, let's hit the pause button. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
You know, why are we existing and stuff? And you and I, we've spoken a little bit about like maybe some of the serious, serious challenges, not only design studios that are faced with, but also education as we're talking about now. I believe I'm optimistic. Mm-hmm. I'm generally an optimist when it comes to these futures or whatever, but I'm an optimist with kind of a careful consideration to reality and to calculated risks
yeah.
that you would take. And I believe that it would also, at the same time that companies pay attention to the lessons learned to, you know, phenomenon like COVID, but also educationally, I think long even before COVID, you know, education is in for a revolution. It needs to be, mm-hmm. Quite frankly, to put it, you know, just straight. It needs to pay attention to, you know, looking over its shoulder and seeing, you know, what's behind it and what yeah. can pass it on the inside lane here or whatever with regard to remote learning and things. You know, if you want to learn car design and you can't afford it or you don't have the means logistically, yeah. let's say, you can learn it on YouTube.
Yeah.
You can learn it, you know, by looking at everything. I mean, there was a time where, you know, I mean, just to see a postage stamp size sketch of a car coming out of Detroit or something in car styling or auto and design or whatever, what that meant was once every 4 months, during my career at Art Center, when I first started going there, I would go down to Kinokuniya bookstore in Little Tokyo in LA and see if they had the latest car styling there, whatever, if it hadn't already been bought up, kind of thing. So I'd pay $25, $30 or whatever at the time for that one issue to get that thing out there to look, and you'd get a magnifying glass and try to decipher what did they do with that sketch, right? Now you just go thunk, and it's what's so and so doing, or who did that, or Instagram account or whatever. You can look at people's postings and things, and God knows that so many designers now, they're not following sort of like a code of confidentiality necessarily of whose IP is it? Yeah. Is it the company's or is it mine? Yeah. Right? Who am I? Have I been given the green light to share this thing on Instagram or whatever and to promote the brand or whatever, et cetera? I mean, in my day, it was like, oh my God, you had to get written permission and legal stuff or whatever. So, but the schools need to make more robust their online learning suite and tools and availability for that kind of thing. They should make sure that they are paying very, very close attention to their diversity. Mm-hmm. And where is this creativity coming from? I mean, it is not creativity doesn't depend on status.
Yeah.
Did you come from a good family? Are you smart? Creativity comes from God knows where, we don't know, right? And so to be able to find these people, all right, and bring them in and saying, hey, we can formally give you, the right path and get your wheels on the track more clearly or whatever, we can really, really work with this, I tell the students all the time, the companies are not hiring you to replicate what they already have in the studio. When I interviewed, or when my managers would interview, and then they would bring me, say, the finalists or something, and I would look at them and I would say, basically, I would look at the portfolios and ask myself, do I have this base already covered inside my studio? Can Daniel do this? Mm-hmm. Can Ray do that? Can John do that? Whatever. I'm looking for you as an individual, right? And I tell the students this right now. I said, everybody's different in here. We all have, our backgrounds are really, really unique, and you're going to be hired ultimately, and your longevity is going to be based on your ability to be an individual and not be like what you saw and how you copied so-and-so and so forth. This isn't the Suzuki method of learning music. We're talking about and it can be really ugly. I try to tell them that, but they don't buy into that. They just want to know how to make the core darker and how to, make it shinier looking, how to bring the reflective light into there or whatever kind of thing. Or if we're talking just pure design, how to make the proportion better, et cetera. But like originality, I'm thinking of actually selling to Art Center an idea of doing a class that's based on the ugliest sketch that a designer does, and seeing if you can develop the ugliest idea that you do at the beginning of the class into a really great original design by the end of the term, kind of thing, just to like break out of the same solution sketching and stuff, whatever that they do, because it quite often resembles stuff that you're familiar with. And that's part of the problem that I find with AI and the college is currently trying to feel their way with how they're either promoting and supporting the usage of AI, but not to the extent where you can't tell whether or not the student did the work or not, kind of thing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but the AI quite often presents itself as derivative of what has already been created in the world, and it's just what's in the library in the cloud, etc.
Well, right? It's also I think this is something that a lot of people misunderstand, is you can work with an AI, but what you need to really learn is a decision-making process. Mm-hmm. Because, if you can't decide between three, how are you supposed to, options, how are you supposed to decide between 30?
Yeah.
Because AI can give you more, but it doesn't make your life necessarily much easier.
Right.
And I think in terms of, the universities, the colleges or whatever, the question is always, and this is my biggest, probably problem, issue with them, is the idea of, do you teach them what a designer is supposed to do? or do you teach them what a stylist is? Somebody who you can make a great sketch and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's the question of, can you critically think about if this is great or not? You know, you can argue, okay, I don't like the Cybertruck from a styling. I don't like the Fiat Multipla in terms of styling, but is it actually a good design?
Yeah.
And if you ask that kind of question, you can then say, well, if it's a good design, I can style it differently and I can make it maybe more appealing.
Yeah.
But you can also say, well, this is a great looking car, but you can't get inside. You know, I mean, there's plenty of examples where this is the case, where people say, well, this is incredible, but then you don't want to sit inside because it's just not functional in any kind of way. And that's a big point, I think, nowadays. And then also to kind of get people hired. Because, you know, if you're a manager, you go on Instagram and you see a lot of really cool sketches, and then you see the sketches of your students and just like, is there really the big difference?
Yeah. I am, like I said, my dreams have come true. I am such a lucky guy. I want to mention a person's name right now. You know, we've heard the names, you know, Chris Bangle or whatever, we throw that around or whatever, clearly the most influential person. Early in my career, my first boss, Charles Taylor, his father was car designer, Ed Taylor. Ed was one of my teachers at Art Center, actually. Brother to Blair, cousin to Jason Hill, and Ron Hill is Jason's father, et cetera. But, Charles gave me my first big break.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't think that, you know, he would be the most renowned, famous name that you would hear out there. But the industry is filled with these, people, good people, talented people. And I learned so much from this guy. I absorbed just about everything that came out of, and he wasn't a huge talker. He was a real doer. He was my manager. He was my boss, but he was incredibly supportive to what I was doing. When you buy a toy train mm-hmm. set, there's that one piece of the track that helps you get the wheels mm-hmm. and you roll it back and forth onto that thing. Well, that was Charles for me. I was this kid that was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I didn't know what I was doing most of my career, basically. but Charles, incredible designer, incredible doer, as Chris Bangle would say, you know, there's the doers, you know, doing the doing, and then, you know, the others. And, you know, he really got me through his own experiences and his own teachings he was working with at Opel in Rüsselsheim at the time when Hideo Kodama was there and a bunch of other people that, you know, long gone on and become these famous names or whatever. He taught me things like a proper tape drawing
mm-hmm.
and things like carkitecture. And, you know, when I think about like what has happened in the design studio over the years and how design has eroded from automobile design to styling, I can follow a very clear path of how something like a proper piano di forma
mm-hmm.
style drawing in Italian coach building or whatever has kind of gone through and down to the sort of stylized full-size tape drawing with taking the tape and cutting it so that it tapers down and then mm-hmm. airbrushing something. And then the car is really ends up being super low and it doesn't end up being a proper representation of what you would do, say, if you were going to loft a ship, you know, and do a proper drawing. And what you see is what you get kind of thing in front of you. That way, when you go to the modeler, when you go to the engineer, that's the line. Mm-hmm. It's not, well, which side of the line or which line are you talking about kind of thing, right? That has eroded the sort of thing into what we now have as styling. And so for me, this is where I would love to be still a part of the industry to turn it. And that's where I feel like perhaps I can have a small contribution in the education is to turn it back and get these students to start understanding the value back on to some of the things that I learned early on from a guy like Charles.
Yeah.
And really use the tools, be the hotshot, you know, do the rendering of the car when you want it and stuff like that. But in terms of developing a design and problem solving something and making something, you know, not only better, but new and original and revolutionary, whatever, you know, that single line. I remember doing a tape drawing. It was like I was working 3 weeks on one tape drawing, full-size tape drawing of a car at Isuzu one time. And it was just, at the time, 6 days a week, at least. We were working every Saturday and it was 10 hour, 11 hour, sometimes 12 hour days. I mean, sitting on that little scooter going back and forth on the wall and back and doing this line drawing and stuff. And when you see the art of it, not the style of it, but the art and the
craftsmanship,
the craft of it. Yeah.
That goes along
in all, not just yourself and then the colleagues that influence you and teach you the right way. I am so grateful to having had, you know, the people that have influenced me, but specifically to that early on, that influential period of time when you're just starting out and you're nurtured, you're held properly, you're supported properly. I wasn't shot down or whatever. I was corrected and I learned whatever. And that was, you know, part of that whole thing. And so, you know, when it came time to, you know, start developing something like the X5, when I went in there, they had models and they were doing different designs and they had a full size or whatever, what they thought they wanted or whatever. And I went in there and I go, that's not a truck. Mm-hmm. And I could say that I could delineate exactly why too, and explain to them why it's not going to work as well if you do it that way and stuff. And so
but that's the influence. I think, you know, the craftsmanship comes then with influence, because then you know what you're talking about and you can discuss on a completely different level. You know, it's not I think the question of, you don't have to be an engineer, but you need to have certain kind of principle understandings to then say like, okay, this is what it is and this is why I think in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
And this is for me a little bit of the challenge at the moment with the education, is because if we're really honest, you can say like, well, if we're just, you know, getting you to be great sketchers, who's going to be the first studio that says, well, then why do I need to hire those guys? I can just go on Instagram and, like, you know, really go through all the filters that I want to set and hire the best sketchers from that perspective. Yeah. I don't need a degree for that.
Yeah.
I think that kind of degree direction is coming in through the craftsmanship, through the potential influence. And yes, that takes a long time.
Yeah.
And you need to be always a bit lucky in the context of, I need to have the right people around me.
Yeah.
But it's also the question of, what are you being taught in the beginning? And also then, what do you want to learn for yourself?
Yeah.
Because I think the pure sketch in itself, and you know this better than I do, but the actual process of creating is like, what, 5%, you know? And this is also for the studios here. If you then have people that are better educated, you don't maybe just do the concept phase and you don't do the first 10, 15%, but the better the people are educated, you might then do 25, 30, 40% in terms of the project, because you have better people and they can argue it in a better kind of way as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's really a core point, and that's where the universities, not just in California, but in, you know, globally, need to step up. But obviously here, the big question is, we have a lot of studios and relatively little output in terms of students.
Yeah.
So, you know, not everybody can be an exterior designer, interior designer, but all the other roles that play, you know, play an important factor into the design process in general.
Yeah.
So we need to make sure that we have, you know, a high quality, but also a realistic expectation into the kids.
Yeah.
I think if we would go in and say like, yeah, you're all going to be exterior designers, I don't really think, you know, that would be true value in terms of what they're studying.
Yeah. Yeah. That percentage hasn't really changed or whatever, but I'm kind of old school when it comes to like technique. And I mean, I believe in technology, and I have pushed in my career this idea of like, what's up? What's Pixar doing, et cetera? And how can that be applied, et cetera? Okay. That's that world. But I am also fundamentally, into fundamentals.
Yeah.
And the way I was trained and steered and controlled, in a very healthy way. I remember there was this, and I tell this story to the students sometimes or whatever. I use a lot of sports analogies, athletics and music as well. But John Wooden, who's the famous basketball coach for UCLA here, or whatever, the Wizard of Westwood. And he did a lesson on how to put your socks on.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sit there, and like you're sitting there right now, and he would take his shoes off and he would take his socks off. And he was this man at the time, you know, in his 50s or 60s or whatever. And his whole team is sitting here, right? And he would say, okay, now you put the sock on like this, and you need to adjust the seam in this way and make sure like this, because, and it would all lead to this idea of like preventing you from getting blisters in your feet, because blisters will impede your ability to play the game, which will impede our ability to win national championships, period, kind of thing. And he would spend a half an hour talking about how to put a sock on, whatever, and with his right foot, he would like, you know, and adjust it like that. And then he would proceed to do his left foot and spend another half an hour talking about how to put your sock on and repeating the lesson and what this means and what this, the obligation that you have to your team members here to put your socks on properly, kind of thing. And I love that lesson or whatever, because all the students, they want to learn how to make a model in Blender and how to do this and how to use this. And sometimes, you know, the industry pushes places, institutions like Art Center to make them, hey, learn, tell them to learn this, tell them to do this, tell them to, you know, and then what happens is they get overloaded with a curriculum that is unrealistic to do well any one of those things. They become ombudsmen, jacks of all trades, but they don't, they're not really, really sound in their fundamentals.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, they're not bouncing the ball and learning how to do a chest pass, learning how to do a bounce pass, learning how to do a baseball pass. They want to learn how to go through the legs and around the back and be like Michael Jordan, et cetera, whatever. And they want it right now.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's no kind of patience for that kind of thing. And so my hope, because I have a lot of hope, my hope is that I can contribute and bring this experience and get the students to understand, calm down.
Yeah.
We'll get there. Okay. I want you to state your problem first. We're going to spend the first 4 weeks of a 14-week class talking about the problem that you identified. You're not going to sketch. Mm-hmm. I want you to research. I want you to do some sound background on why you're doing what you're doing, what, who the customer is, what is the problem that you're trying to, what are you trying to accomplish, all that kinds of stuff, before you really kind of put serious pencil to paper, kind of thing, you know? We'll see. We'll see if I'm successful. I taught 30 some odd years ago when I was first out of school. I'm from a family of educators. I quite consider what I did over my career as kind of a coach.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're in the design studio, and I liked being thought of as a coach.
I know a lot of designers always hate when I say this, but a design team is very, very similar to a sports team.
It is. I don't hate that. I think that is.
But you're one of very, very few, because, you know, a lot of designers don't have that connection with the sports.
But they don't. Yeah, it's like, you know, Formula One maybe, or skiing or something like that. Yeah. But like, something like a team sport, like basketball or football, or, you know, it's, you know, there are clear analogies.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, you know, I remember Chris Bangle actually one point said, here's a book. And he handed it to me. He goes, everything you need to know about managing people or whatever is in that book. And I looked at it, and it was by Jerry Kramer, who was an offensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers. And his stories about his interactions with Vince Lombardi at the time and the championships and things like that or whatever. When you read it, you realize, ah, that's what Chris is meaning. Ah, that's, a, you know, what his style or whatever directly connects to, you know, that whole thing of interacting with people and getting them to you know, quite often, I would purposely try to distract, you know, a designer from thinking a certain way, kind of thing, with humor or with sort of, hey, look over here kind of thing, squirrel kind of thing, whatever, to get them off of the pressures that they may be feeling with regard to trying to find something new and creative, you know? It's the same thing that a guy like Joe Montana did in the Super Bowl one time, where he, you know, they were, had 2 minutes left. They had to march the full length of the field in order to win the Super Bowl. And he gets in the huddle and he looks over and he says, hey, isn't that John Candy? You know, the actor John Candy over there on the sidelines or whatever. And all the guys like looking over there or whatever, to relieve the pressure, to relieve some of the stress, to relieve some of the lockup that you might feel, you know, writer's block, if you have that or whatever, if you're a writer, to in order to loosen up the gears, in order to create and maybe find something new. So techniques like that coming from coaches, coming from athletics, quite often, you know, music is something that designers can relate to. They're quite often musicians, quite good musicians as well, you know, and there's plenty of stories. And,
I think if you would, maybe we should do a sports podcast, you know, sports for designers or something like that.
It's endless. It's endless, right?
No. I think we would have great fun.
I love it. I mean, I would quite often, you know, like with a designer, if they're not feeling it and we're looking at the full size model and it's kind of dead and it's kind of static and we're losing emotion or whatever. And I would often say, hey, you know, stand, I would have the designer stand. And I say, stand the way you think the car wants to stand. Like in what kind of stance is it? You know, I physically get them to act it out. I've quite often thought that, you know, designers, a lot introverts, they're kind of into themselves or whatever, and to kind of pull them out or whatever, I think would be really good to have them sort of take drama class or do some of the exercises that are associated with theater or with comedy, and figure out a way to express what they're trying to say or whatever in, say, a physical manifest in their body language or something, or shout it out or express themselves in so a lot of other things. I feel like a basketball player can be a much better basketball player if they play soccer.
Yeah.
If they cross, you know, train something else. If you learn about another thing a little bit, it can influence your main game really, really well. So yeah, in complete agreement to, you know, other areas, but athletics to me are just, I mean, the guys that will listen to this that know me or whatever are going to roll their eyes, but I would do this all the time. And unfortunately right now with the students, the references that I have, they're going, who?
Who's Joe McCann?
What are you talking about?
Well, you know, have to talk about Tom Brady now.
Yeah, you have to, you know, move it into other sports or whatever and Messi or whatever and try to, you know, make that connection and stuff. But my hope is that I can connect on that level so that we can get – you can't force them.
Yeah.
You know, they'll shut off. I mean, I remember when I was a student, all I was interested in is how those guys did those sketches and stuff like that. It wasn't like design. What are you talking to me about design? You know, kind of thing. But we do need to do this because car design, you know, we discussed a little bit early, you know, you want to feel good about what you're looking at.
And you want the excitement as well.
Yeah. You know? You want the wow factor. You want to be able to envy and you know, your decision on purchasing a car should be really hard based on I want that, not like, well,
maybe this.
I guess I just, that's the less of all evils because that'll suit my needs, kind of, you know, boring. You know what I mean? I mean, when we get to that level, it's all over, you know.
Indeed. But Chris, I think we could continue for hours and hours and hours and hours, but thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure.
And maybe we do that, you know, Design X Sports podcast at
some point. I'll be right there with you. We support in any way I can.
We would probably have to do it on video and then just like put it into people all the time and just like, this is who we're talking about. Yeah. You know, this is like, you know, this is that guy. And
yeah, all these things. No, but, it's been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate it.
Thank you very, very much. And to all of our listeners, we really, really hope you enjoyed this episode once again. And we will be back very, very soon with the next episode on the season on car design in California. So until then, all the best and take care.